with Bologna from yesterday. Tonight we have Inter Fiorentina, but to talk a little bit about Real Madrid and a little bit about Turkish football as well is a man joining us on the line today. He is already in waiting. He's a man who we love to get into the finer details and the darkest holes of European football with. We're going to keep it big style with him today, though, and keep it with some of the major leagues and not try and catch him off his guard. He is, of course, Mr. Andy Brassel, joining us here on World Football Daily. Andy, man, it's a pleasure to have you on the show, as always. How are you?
Thanks very much, Ollie. How are you?
I'm very well indeed, very well indeed. Recovering from a couple of late nights of sleep, but I think as long as you know, you're so entertaining, Andy, on the show, I think it's going to help me stay awake, that's for sure, mate, that's for sure.
Let's hope so.
Let's get straight down into some of the major stories from European football this week, and really, what was quite a big story this week and has continued into the latter stages of this week has been Turkish football and the I want to say altercations, but it was a lot more than just an altercation on the pitch between fans. Beşiktaş against Galatasaray, obviously a big rivalry between these two sides from Istanbul and Turkish football, but this is so much more than just a football riot, isn't it, Andy?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what's been notable in the days since is quite a lot of support for the Beşiktaş fans from Galatasaray fans, because, you know, there's been a feeling that perhaps it was something that was politically staged discredit Beşiktaş. And of course there was such incredible unity between fans of the big three, and such a bitter rival Beşiktaş and Fenerbahçe and Galatasaray in the political demonstrations that lasted in Istanbul over the summer. So what I think is great, obviously it's a not great situation socially and politically for the people of Istanbul and for Beşiktaş as a club. What is great is that the fans of these three clubs have had myriad differences over the years, but they seem to still be standing together.
It's very peculiar to see them standing together on this sort of situation, as you say, Andy, because there has been such a divide. When you look, what do you think is going to be the escalation from this in any way, shape or form? I mean, is this going to be actually seen as a bonding for these two sets of fans, or for the kind of the near future and the extended future?
Well, I would like to think so. I mean, I spoke to Fatty to him, as you maybe earlier this year, a couple of months back, the Blizzard, and you know, he was saying one of the things that had to change in Turkish football was, you know, the bitterness of the rivalry, particularly the one between Fenerbahce and Galatasaray, where of course you've had all sorts of unedifying violence. You've had no away fans in Istanbul derbies for, well, now it's the third season in a row, which is obviously very, very sad, because it's a great showpiece and football is about fans and, you know, a rivalry within acceptable boundaries. And, you know, he said when he was a player, the players and the fans used to go to dinner together after the game. And he said, really urgently, I think was the word he used, have to get back to those times. So, I mean, obviously it would be better if it wasn't a situation like this that goes far beyond football and, you know, goes into people's civil liberties and something far more important than football. Nevertheless, football often is like society in microcosm. So if, you know, this could, something good could come out of it, that would be great.
I don't want to sound like a broken record, Andy, but I mean, is this just another kind of method that shows that the changing face of football, with the players being so removed from the fans, etc., as the years have gone on, has actually been so detrimental? Do you think this sort of attitude of, if fans and players were able to mix after games and fans could feel far more involved with their clubs, do you think that would work across Europe and across the world in ways of stamping out these sorts of violent scenes that we're used to seeing and the aggression in football?
To be honest, I understand what you're saying about polarisation of players from the fans, but I don't really think that's necessarily something that needs to be of it for fans to feel close to their club, and, you know, for fans to make the most of getting involved in their club. Mm. There are lots of ways you can do that. There are lots of clubs where people do. And of course, where is the players maybe the visible face of a club on the pitch? They come and go, but they're not really that important. You know, we keep going. whether our team sell their star player or buy rubbish ones or whatever, you know, you're just stuck with team support, and that's the that's the end of it, really. And you know, the experience of supporting the club, you know, is about, you know, the emotion you feel no matter what players are on the pitch, and you know, the experience of going to the game and, you know, enjoying your whole day, really. So for me, the players aren't really connected to that. I suppose it would be nice, especially for younger fans, if there was more of a closeness and more of an accessibility to players. But personally, it's not something I see as hugely essential to the general experience of being a football fan.
Now, you touched on Fatih Terim there, and it's not been a great week for him. Fatih dismissed as Galatasaray's coach. How big a step is this? I mean, Fatih was only brought in really as kind of the interim manager, if you will, but he is such an iconic figure in Turkish football, being removed from really an iconic club, but it's not been the best start either from Galatasaray this season.
It has been a little slow, but I'm not sure you can really stack up a sporting reason for firing him. I mean, you know, you've got two leagues, two Super Cups, Champions League quarter-final in the two seasons. Bear in mind, the season before he took over, I think it was 11. You know, this was a club, a giant club, in absolute disarray before he came back. He reinstilled discipline and pride, and as is his way, did it playing really great attacking football. A lot of Galatasaray fans are very despondent about this, and you know, I completely understand them, because not just because someone who puts so much in and loves the club so much has been taken away from it and had it taken away from him. But just how are they going to get anyone better? How are they going to get anyone who gets the club better? And I think a lot of people there on the ground in Turkey just thinking, well, you know, what is this obsession we've got with overseas coaches? And you know, look at the names linked to the club. There's not a Turkish name in there. They want a big name just to try and appease the fans. And you know, you wonder, are people are really going to have a grasp of the team, have a grasp of Turkish culture and Turkish football culture? And I think that is really important, because of course Galatasaray have a lot of overseas players and a lot of high-profile overseas players. That's clear. But I think what Terim did really well, especially in his first spell, and also in his second spell, is sort of ally really good domestic players with top overseas names, and you know, not just by Turkey's all there for the money, but you know, getting players like Drogba, you know, someone who can really lead by example, a real legend of the game. And of course, he was moving it on, bringing Bruma in. You know, that was a real step forward, I think, for the Turkish game in general, because they were bringing in a young player who was coveted by Premier League clubs, by Spanish clubs, and, you know, someone who could go on to be a real world star, rather than just, you know, someone who's maybe at the back end of their career looking for a big payday. So I can understand why the fans are concerned, A, because Terim is an iconic figure, and B, because they have to worry about, you know, what is the direction of the club. And you know, they've been in a great position before. If you go back to the last time they were in the Champions League quarterfinals in 2001, the year after they won the UEFA Cup against Arsenal, of course. And you know, they had a terrific team then, and it all fell apart. So you know, you need to know there's real stability and real direction. Otherwise, they could, you know, dig themselves back into a hole pretty quickly.
You can get more thoughts on Turkish football on the Turkish Football Podcast on worldfootballdaily.com. Andy, we'll move away from Turkish football now, and we won't get onto the topic of comparing Fatih Terim's dismissal to Paolo Di Canio's. Even less games for Terim, of course. Only the four after the game between Beşiktaş and Galatasaray was abandoned after that crowd control incident. Let's have a look at Real Madrid just quickly. Last night, it was pretty much a get-out-of-jail-free card for Madrid yesterday evening. Pepe goes down after he seems to be manhandling his defender. And we're used to hearing Jose Mourinho in Madrid talking about the fix being in for Barcelona from UEFA. Now Gerard Piqué and Barcelona saying that Real Madrid are getting a bias from referees. Do you genuinely feel, we hear it all the time with Manchester United, that Madrid do get the luck of the draw when it comes to refereeing decisions in Spain?
I think you have to look at the particular referee who made this decision. He gave some very, very favourable decisions to Barcelona in their home game against Sevilla a couple of weeks ago. So, you know, if anything, if you think this referee is biased, you know, he's helped Barcelona as much as he's helped Madrid, because, of course, he chalked off what was looking like a good winning goal for Sevilla. And Barcelona went straight up the other end and scored the winner there in stoppage time there at the Camp Nou. But I think what was the most concerning thing about this decision, I mean, it was such a bad decision that even Mata, who, you know, no one's in any doubt where less of his life, said, Pep conned the referee. if they're saying that, it's bad. It's really bad. And of course, you know, a club like Elche as well, who are not expected to stay up, having got a last-minute equaliser against Real Madrid, having played a very, very good game, made them very uncomfortable. You know, it's the cruelest twist possible. So in the context of where it happened, who it happened against, the point of the game it happened, it's very, very unedifying.
When you look at the Elche performance, as you say, it was a very good performance and a really beautifully worked goal for Boake to find the equaliser on 90 minutes. Will there be teams that will be looking at this Elche performance and seeing how they can break down and shut down Real Madrid? Because there's been so much talk about them being all-powerful Los Blancos this year with signing Bale and whatnot. But there's still plenty of ways, it seems, to slow down their moves forward and for lesser teams to really pick them off.
I think so. But for me, Ollie, the most interesting thing will be when we come to the Madrid derby on Saturday, because Real Madrid just looked so open under Ancelotti on the whole. And, you know, they're going to come out and attack that game. It's players' home debut. He's going to be very keen to have a go as well. And because of Atleti going there and winning the cup final at the Bernabeu back in May, you know, maybe they feel that hoodoo where they didn't beat Real Madrid for so long. Maybe they feel now that's broken, you know, they can step up and play against them with a little more confidence. In so many Madrid derbies, Atleti have just retreated into their shell. So I guess like, there are two questions. One, will Atleti be able to stand up and reproduce the sort of quality of performance that started the season with, because it's been very, very impressive. And two, I guess, you know, will they be able to take advantage of the openness of Real Madrid, or will, because they come out and have a go, will that give Real Madrid more of an opportunity to get after them?
I'm sure there'll be plenty of Atletico Madrid fans who will be hoping for a repeat of the Copa del Rey final from last May. It was an unbelievable game and an unbelievable moment for Atletico Madrid fans. Madrid do look exposed under Ancelotti. Andy, we're going to have to leave it there. I apologise for it being such a short chat today. We would love to have you on for a little longer, but I'm afraid the world just has, football just doesn't stop, unfortunately, and neither can we here at World Football Daily. We really appreciate you taking a bit of time out to have a chat with us today, though, mate, and especially to fill us in on Galatasaray and Fatih Terim and what this club is going to do now with this iconic manager gone. And we look forward to catching up with you very soon indeed, mate.
Take care. See you
Cheers,
soon.
Andy. Have a very good day. Andy Brassel there joining us here on World Football Daily, talking a little bit of Fatih Terim here on WFD. Very brief there from Andy, but the reason why we're being brief is because we have our next guest for the show lined up, ready and waiting. He's on a bit of a tight schedule, but I'm delighted to say that joining me now here on World Football Day to talk a little bit of CONCACAF Champions League and, of course, Major League Soccer as well, is the one, the only, Mr. Brian Dunseth here on WFD. Brian, man, how are you doing today? Been a busy day for you travelling, I hear.
Yeah, man, first flight out. I up at 4 a.m. trying to get the first plane home and spend at least what looks to be at least 24 hours at home before I head up to Vancouver. So always good to be on the loose.
I was going
to
say, football never stops, so I guess it kind of means that you're not allowed to either, right?
Not at all. But as I always say, the swindle continues. I've got the dream job, and They're going to have to pry this job out of my fingers because I'm not giving this one up.
Always good to hear somebody who not only works in football for a living but absolutely loves it as well. I'm sure, Brian, the LA Galaxy were loving last night, booking their place into the final rounds, the knockout stages of the CONCACAF Champions League. My question to you, though, Brian, first, before we analyse the Galaxy's performance, is how can a team like the LA Galaxy take a reserve team to Costa Rica and win on the road, yet the US men's national team, a stronger team, can go to Costa Rica and balls things up so badly?
You know, it's a great question. And I think what it boils down to is, you know, Bruce Arena historically in this tournament has primarily used a younger lineup. And in particular, since CONCACAF changed the format to only four games, home and away, with some breakup dates in there, the LA Galaxy started their first two games at home. It was a little bit of a tainted schedule because of their commitment to being a super club, to being the flagship bearer for this league and playing in international tournaments in the summer. So it condensed their schedule, made it a little bit more difficult, and I think ultimately forced Bruce Arena to continue with that philosophy of playing young guys on the road in CONCACAF Champions League, because he had to save guys like Landon, save guys like Robbie Keane, even an Omar Cummings and company, to make sure that they did everything possible to prepare for this final run-up to MLS. So very, very difficult. Great result on the road. Jack McBean continues to develop as a young player against international competition. And it's good to see a guy like Chandler Hoffman get his first goal for the Galaxy on the road. And what you said was a very tough place to play.
Now, obviously the Galaxy sweeping past Cartaginés last night away from home in Costa Rica. That 3-0 win, very comfortable indeed. And the young players, do you think they show more than they maybe would do if they were getting intermittent time a lot in Major League Soccer, because they know that the CONCACAF Champions League is their chance to shine?
Absolutely, absolutely. And again, I think historically in this tournament, you've seen younger players do very, very well in this tournament, in this format, and then kind of parlay that playing experience into a starting opportunity in a Major League Soccer. The hardest part for young players or established players that aren't playing game in, game out, is to get ready for reserve league games. I mean, it's just very, very difficult to get up. They see that as more of a punishment as opposed to an opportunity. So when you're able to travel, when you're able to get that feel that you're a first team player, that, you know, this is a quote unquote international opportunity to put yourself in the shop window, I think the players grasp it with both hands. And I think that's what you're seeing for these young players for the LA Galaxy.
Now, the Galaxy will obviously be in the next round in the knockout stages of CONCACAF Champions League. A big, long break, though, between the end of the group stages and the knockout stages. Do you expect Bruce, when it comes to the knockout, to once again start bringing in the key players from his first team squad to ensure progression? Or do you think it's right and will he stick with the kids?
No, I think the kids are out the window and the big boys are back in. I think, again, once you go from the group stage, even though it's unforgiving, and you transition into a knockout round of quarterfinals, semifinals, finals, it's the group stage you're expected to win as an MLS team, as long as you don't face a Mexican club. Mm. Now you get into the business portion of this tournament. It's a little bit more difficult. One of the reasons why MLS is starting a little bit earlier, to give MLS teams a better opportunity to get games, get fitness, get a little bit more tactical sharpness before they head into facing either a very good team like Olimpia from Honduras or what has historically been a Saprissa from Costa Rica, if it wasn't a Mexican squad. And the good thing in this time around with CONCACAF Champions League is there's no team running away with it. There's no Monterrey. There's no Santos Laguna. There's not a huge goal differential. So I think it's a better opportunity for MLS teams to avoid a big Mexican club in the quarterfinal stage, which will be huge because that home and away series will buy you essentially another 3 to 4 weeks to get ready for facing a Mexican team.
And there's potentially still some Mexican sides that can go out and obviously haven't booked their place in yet in the final stages. I mean, you look at, for instance, Club America. They take on in their group Sporting San Miguelito and Alajuelense. And America haven't dominated this group as expected. Is it a sign that we keep talking about this in CONCACAF Champions League football, but is Mexican club football getting weaker, or are they just not as bothered by CONCACAF Champions League and instead it's more about Copa Lib and Copa Sudamericana?
Yeah, I think that's it more than anything. I think, quite honestly, some of these clubs in Mexico, they don't take it seriously. Santos Laguna and Monterrey absolutely do. I think historically Pumas has taken it seriously. But outside of that, I think it's more of a curse than a blessing for these clubs to take part in CONCACAF Champions League. And a reason why you'll see not reserve teams being put out, but essentially under 23 teams being put out by a majority of the Mexican clubs that don't respect it. So they'll learn the hard way. And more than anything, it'll be an ego bruise for them in the short term. In the long term, they won't care. But yeah, I think honestly, that's kind of the formula for some of these Mexican teams that aren't taking it seriously. They're going to roll out the young kids, hope to get them experience, and hope for the best. And if it doesn't work, they're truthfully not really going to care that much.
In that sense, then, with the Major League Soccer sides kind of playing the reserve teams, at least in these group stages and whatnot, we saw it with the Houston Dynamo as well in their 2-0 win yesterday evening, actually. And the Mexican side is treating it like that. Is there ever, do you think, going to be a call, Brian, from Major League Soccer sides to say, why not let us, we're head and shoulders above the Honduran sides, the Panamanian sides, etc. Why not let us have a go at Copa Libertadores or Copa, maybe not Copa Sudamericana, but because Mexican sides obviously are able to enter it, and the US, you know, are just a border away from that?
To be honest with you, I think it's a travel issue. I think that it would be very, very interesting from a player's perspective to be involved in that competition. But what it comes down to, again, is the conversations that I've had with coaches is we don't get fired or hired based on CONCACAF Champions League or Copa Sudamericana. We get fired on that alone. And Major League Soccer, they feel like their accountability is with MLS alone. And I agree with them. It is, and rightfully so. If you could figure out a way to financially make it feasible for the players, for the club to enter that tournament and ultimately open up the roster sizes, I think it makes it much more interesting. Because of right now, the difference between a Mexican salary structure, top to bottom, and the infrastructure necessary is there. For Major League Soccer, it's not. And it's one of the reasons why I've been calling for this for a long time. We're at the point, Major League Soccer, where the salary cap needs to be $5 million per team. There's a lot of mechanisms that allow teams to go out and find players and essentially hide players and hide their salary. But I think the books should be open. We should be to the point where we've got the soccer-specific stadiums for the most part. We're on an upward trend. I know that television revenue is going to be the huge argument because that's where the money is made, or not made in MLS's case. But to get to that next level, I think you got to spend the money. And now it's time to open up the war chest. Cooler heads should prevail, and there should be an accountability from the top to the bottom to recognize that if we want to win the FIFA World Cup, if we want to enter these bigger tournaments, you have to give coaching staffs and organizations the opportunity to go out and find the players and subsidize their salary the right way. And unless you do that, you're just spinning your wheels and you're just talking.
But surely opening up salary caps, expanding budgets, and is always going to entice more players to come from outside the US into Major League Soccer rather than finding homegrown talent.
Yeah, and by that I still mean that homegrown talents are incredibly essential, but I think as important as we are talking about developing MLS team or MLS players, I think we also have to be open to the idea of selling these young players and capitalizing. You know, you've seen a little bit more of that lately, but a guy like Jeff Cameron, who's 26 years of age, and slides seamlessly into the right back position for Stoke City, you know, that's a good thing for us. That is a fantastic thing for Major League Soccer. We should be an import-export league. And I think that's where you develop, because for young kids to develop, you have to challenge them by putting them around amazing players. And I know what it was like as a young player in this league, being around guys that had this incredible international experience. And it forced you to step up. It forced you to develop as a player, not physically, not just physically, but also egotistically. Because you never wanted to be the guy that David Beckham was going to yell at because you botched up a simple pass or a simple buildup. You wanted to be the guy that David Beckham was giving plaudits to in the press, saying, "Man, keep an eye on this kid. He's the next up and coming guy." So it works in both scenarios, and I think it's important to continue to see that import export that develop and take advantage of the amount of money that's out there for young American players, because I think what that old mechanism and thought was, he's an American. He's a good soccer player, but he's American. I don't think that matters anymore with what we've seen and how far we've come over the last 10 years with, the young American international.
It's obviously a game that's growing in the US, and Major League Soccer is getting ever more popular. I'm going to use the San Jose Earthquakes to seamlessly weave us in, Brian, from CONCACAF Champions League into Major League Soccer. The Earthquakes are on the cusp, really, of both playoff positions and of going through from Group 5 in CONCACAF Champions League. Yet, for all fits and purposes, it's been a pretty dire year for them after such an explosive year last year. What's gone wrong with San Jose this season, Brian? Do you think they have the ability to still pull it all off at the end of the year?
Yes. To answer your final two questions, yes, I do, both in Major League Soccer and in CONCACAF Champions League. The simple answer is they're healthy. The realistic answer, and I've been saying this for a long time, is nothing has changed for San Jose outside of the fact that they just stopped scoring goals. Wondolowski last year had 27 goals. Lenhart had 13 goals. And if I'm not mistaken, Gordon had around 14 or 15 goals. Chavez, I want to say, had something like 13, 14 assists. Simon Dawkins had 8 goals coming out of the midfield. That's the only thing that changed. They were a leaky team defensively last year, and they've stayed the exact same this year. They give up unnecessary goals. I think they've settled in a little bit more with Clarence Gibson. But Victor Bernardes has been a liability. He's been a liability since he's got to Major League Soccer. He's big, he's strong, he's physical, but he gets caught up within the game. And nothing's really changed. John Bush has been hung out to dry time and time again. There's nothing that's changed except they stopped scoring goals. And I think you saw that last year when the LA Galaxy went up to San Jose and Robbie Keane and Landon Donovan just cut him open. That game, they didn't score. And that whole Goonies never say die mentality, it's still there. That team will still battle. They got size, they got strength in the air with Gordon and Lenhart. They've got movement off the ball with Wondolowski. But if they don't score, you're in trouble. Because, San Jose is gonna give you a good 3 or 4 decent goal-scoring opportunities during a game. And Victor Bernardes is good for one big mistake each and every game. So I think they're starting to round into form, and I think you're starting to see Lenhart and Gordon healthy. Chris Wondolowski's just been forced to do it by himself this year, and he hasn't had the same service that he's had last year.
Wondo, obviously a bit of a come down after the year he had last year, Brian. Just finally, before we let you go, because we've taken up plenty of your time already, Brian, but just one last quick one. Is the New York Red Bulls always a side in Major League Soccer that are considered the nearly team? So much expectation from them, yet never quite able to do it. This season, though, they seem to have got over that hump, if you will, sat on top of the Eastern Conference and looking like a real powerhouse going into the playoffs finally, rather than maybe dribbling out at the end of the season, as we have sometimes seen.
Yeah, and it's a huge surprise, I think, for everyone, considering Mike Pecky was, shock and awe was going around the Major League Soccer circles when they named Pecky head coach. Great guy, an incredibly fierce competitor as a player, but not a lot of coaching experience. He handled some of the reserve stuff, but was primarily transitioning still from being a player to being a coach. So to see him have full reins, The best move that was made was they brought in Rhodon Fraser. You have a guy with coaching experience, with league experience, and incredibly brilliant with his tactics and his defensive shape and how he works with players. So I am incredibly happy for them. I think the reports of Thierry Henry mixing it up with Mike Pecky and then subsequently his benching and how he handled it publicly was the best case scenario for that club, and ultimately I think was a motivating factor for the success they've had recently. But I just truthfully don't believe that there's going to be a team out of the East that's going to win the MLS Cup. I don't think they're good enough. I think that conference is incredibly weak. It's been Jekyll and Hyde all season long from every single team. And I just don't think there's a team that's good enough to be consistent in the playoffs, which isn't about the games. It's about the war of attrition.
It's going to be the Sounders. I hear what you're saying, Brian. I very much hear what you're saying. Thank you so much, mate, for joining us here on World Football Daily. We know you're busy traveling about the place today, and I know you want to get home, so we will let you get off and back and on your way back home before you have to head off once again around the States to cover more football. But we do appreciate the time, mate, and we look forward to catching up with you very soon indeed.
I appreciate it, man. As always, let me know. I love talking with you guys.
Cheers, Brian. Thanks so much. We'll get you on ASAP. But for now, that was Brian Dunseth joining us here on World Football Daily, talking all things Major League Soccer. And of course, big game coming up for the Portland Timbers against the LA Galaxy. A nice acid test for them as they head into the playoffs. Finally, the Timbers getting a season right after such a disappointing year last year when there was so much expectation on them. And really showing the Pacific Northwest how they roll, if you will. Unfortunately for them, it's all been about the Seattle Sounders and this excellent finish. They've got two games in hand over most teams around them, or at least one game in hand over everybody in Major League Soccer at the moment. The Sounders 50 points. Only the Red Bulls have more in the Eastern Conference. And the Sounders looking good to finish strong. Just 8 losses this season. 5 losses, though, for the Portland Timbers. So it's going to be a Pacific Northwest Western Conference this season. I'd love to see a Sounders Timbers showdown. I think that will be an absolutely incredible atmosphere for the Western Conference final. We're going to follow Major League Soccer as it continues this season. But for now, big thanks to Brian. A big thanks to Andy Brassel as well for joining us here on World Football Daily. There are fixtures taking place tonight in CONCACAF Champions League as well. I will.